from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Journalist Scott Tong's father is an immigrant success story, fleeing China in 1949 and becoming an engineer in the U.S. at IBM. But it wasn't until Tong became a Shanghai bureau chief for Public Radio's marketplace that he learned about relatives, like his uncle, who didn't make it out.
I didn't know his story, and it is this great undertold story of what happened behind the curtain of China under Mao. His story is one of great suffering, being punished during the Cultural Revolution, and the reason he was punished was because he had overseas relations.
Scott Tong joins us in studio to talk about his family history, how it reflects the dramatic changes in China, and his new book, A Village with My Name, next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. When journalist Scott Tong moved to Shanghai to open a China bureau for the radio show Marketplace, he also seized the opportunity to reconnect with his extended family. He discovered that their stories reflect the radical changes and political shifts modern China has undergone, and he joins us in studio this hour to talk about his book, A Village with My Name, Family History of China's Opening to the World. Scott Tong is currently a correspondent for Marketplace's Sustainability Desk, where he covers energy, environment, natural resources, and the global economy. And welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Michael, for having me.
Good to have you here. Yeah, great to have you here. This is quite an ambitious book. I mean, there's five stories in here, really, but it's a whole history of China, and it's what we used to call long-form journalism. Let's start with the opening that you start with, which is the grand opening. This is your paternal great-grandfather, who is a kind of scholar and decided to, open up to the world.
I learned with my father in the course of researching this book, but that my great-grandfather was, in our side of the family, the first out of the village, right? The first mover out of the village where everyone's surname is Tong, and ours is quite unusual in Chinese. And he was a scholar who had the opportunity to leave the village, which is this not particularly remarkable village along the Grand Canal in China. And he had an opportunity to go where most of the scholars went at the time, late in the 1800s, and that was to Japan. Japan, as you know, modernized and opened up to the outside world a generation earlier than China attempted to do. And so the leading ideas of modernity and the isms of the world were there. Capitalism, feminism, Darwinism, empiricism, Marxism, all of these concepts of modernity that were new to China were these ideas that these scholars interacted with. And so my great-grandfather had an opportunity to be one of these cultural middlemen.
Well, Japan had been closed off for a long time until Admiral Perry came. You get the sense. I mean, he came back with a Japanese wife. Mm-hmm. Of course, he had a Chinese wife too.
That came as a great surprise to his Chinese wife back in the village. But everybody's family has one of those stories.
And finding your own village with your own name. I mean, this is not to be confused with the Tongs.
Different character.
Yes.
Yeah, no, not as
well known in San Francisco.
Not as gangster dramatic as that one. Right. Yeah, different.
But you were looking for your family history. Yep. and discovered so much of it, and so much of it tied to China. When people think about China, they think of this vast, you know, going back to the empire and so many different Chinas, and I think it's part of the point. There's a kind of dialectic in your book. You know, you go from suddenly it's opening up, and then it's closed again under the Cultural Revolution of Mao, and then it opens again and so forth, and there are real people who are affected by all this, your family.
I think the big kind of sweeping moments in time that my relatives have been a part of have been going back to an earlier era of globalization in the world. And in China's case, it was connected to the outside world. And the people in my family who lived in that era were these cultural middlemen who saw great opportunity. They were the opportunists. They were some of the scholars. And another person on my family tree, my maternal grandmother, she interacted with American women missionaries. So in that period, there was a great flourishing of ideas that my ancestors and relatives had an opportunity to be part of. And then when the communists came to China and the door closed and the drawbridge got raised, my relatives became the prisoners and the scapegoats in Chinese history. And then in the late 70s, when China started to open up again, once again on the Tong, in the Tong story, my family story, they once again were the opportunists and were the pictures of this broader Chinese redemption story. So I really think of this this period as today's China as a resumption of a process that began more than a century ago.
Well, you mentioned your maternal grandmother. I mean, her feet were bound. I mean, talk about traditional China. And I'm fascinated with learning English and America and all that. And to a great extent, that became a liability. I mean, once a new China moved into place. A serious liability. In fact, your father's story is really quite a fascinating one, too. But he winds up in America, and there's a kind of punishment for those who would associate with just relatives in America. That was how strict it was under Mao.
That's right. So in those two characters, relatives in that I had the opportunity to write about, my maternal grandmother, I didn't know that she chronicled her entire life in these English language letters to the teacher she had. Someone decided in 1911 that this girl was going to have her feet, which were bound and made it very hard to walk for girls, and unbound her feet, and she became part of this early generation of Chinese girls to run and to read. And historians, feminist historians, say these were some of the early breakthroughs for Chinese women and literacy for girls. And she had this great opportunity to become part of that. She wanted her whole life to come to the United States because she kept hearing from her teachers about America. In the end, for a lot of different reasons, she didn't make it to the United States. In a way, it happened a generation later with her daughter, my mother. But when the communists came, she was and her family were punished because of their associations with the outside world.
But America, of course, was the gold mountain for so many Chinese who came here.
Sure.
And it was a major magnet, I mean, for so long. I mean, your dad came here, and that story is, I mean, this should be a major motion picture. I mean, two ships set sail, your dad's on one of them, the other one like the Titanic. I mean, really.
I did know this story when, in 1949, when a lot of the refugees from the losing side of the Chinese Civil War, the American backside that lost to the communists, these refugees were scrambling on ships to go to Taiwan. The ship before the one my dad and his dad got on is the one that sank. Casualties on the order of the Titanic at the time. So remarkable moments of luck, grace, whatever the word is, he gets to northern Taiwan and builds this life, connected to globalization, and comes to the United States as a graduate student in the 60s. His brother is left behind. And my opportunity when I moved to Shanghai was to learn a lot about this uncle.
Of course, by the time you moved to Shanghai, things were pretty modern, to put it mildly. I think Shanghai had, at one point, probably the time you were there, more bars than almost any place, including in the Western world.
Oh, more everything. With a billion people, you're going to have more, really short people, really tall people, more anything. And it was growing so quickly when I was there. The first full year I was there, 2007, the economy, according to the World Bank, grew at 14%. It's kind of remarkable growth. You know, the economy is going 80 miles per hour. And my uncle is able to kind of help me understand that this is part of a broader redemption story for China.
And your uncle was punished too, wasn't he?
Oh, my goodness. He paid a significant price because of his connections to the outside world. So in the late 1950s, when he was, 10 years old or so, China went through what's called the Great Leap Forward, and that turned into a man-made famine. 40 million people died, worst recorded famine in history. And he tells the story of how he would scrape bark off the tree and how his mother would prepare it, kind of marinate it, so they could—
Still a big dish in North Korea, I think.
That's the story of famine, right? Yeah. Whatever you can consume. He talked about the fortunate day when he found a frog on the way back from school. So living through that, his family had fewer rations than others because they were politically stained. They were connected to relatives in Taiwan. And then about a decade later, what's known as the Cultural Revolution comes, and that is the height of the Mao era's political witch hunts to root out the people who are of the wrong political class, and he's certainly one of them. So he gets sent down to the countryside for a decade. They close down all the universities in China, and this is the political craziness of the time. But his redemption is when China opens up again, he takes the college entrance examination with a whole lot of students from China waiting to get an education, and he aces the test.
And you mentioned redemption. Can you help me with pronunciation? Is it Gage Kaifeng?
Geiger Kaifeng.
Geiger Kaifeng.
Geiger Kaifeng,
yeah.
Reform and opening. And those are that's the shorthand to describe what Deng Xiaoping and his reforms, political and economic reforms for China have brought. So if you go to China today, very often you ask a random person on the street, a dumpling seller, a taxi driver, how his or her life is doing. The story tends to start in the late 70s with Geiger Kaifeng, because that is, you know, when the battle days started to end and things began to get better. And that's an important part of the story, but to me, that's just a recent chapter in the history. And what's important, I think, is to understand some of these deeper roots that go back to days that precede the Communist Party. And in some cases, these roots are more international and more global.
Talking, if you just joined us, with Scott Tong. He's correspondent for Marketplace, author of A Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. And he'll be at Half Moon Bay Brewing Company this evening at 6 o'clock. But he's here with us, and we're going to invite you to join this conversation. Particularly, many of you have perhaps been looking for your Chinese roots, many of you here in the Bay Area or beyond. I keep thinking about reading your book. I kept thinking about Napoleon, you know, that famous quote of his, China sleeps while it sleeps. When it awakes, the world will shake, or depending how you move the world, how you interpret. And it's moving the world now. I mean, it's in a leadership role in many people's minds and environment, because we've gone out of the Paris Agreement, and in so many other ways financially. I mean, we owe them more money than I think has ever been on the bill in terms of owed money anywhere in the globe. But you get back to globalization and in so many instances in your book. And could you say something about a metaphor you used, which is the elephant? We're not talking about the GOP here.
Yes.
We're talking about China and globalization.
Well, the best economic historians think about the long story of China's place in the world. If you go back to the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, the Chinese economy was on par with Western Europe. And that is a great source of pride for a lot of Chinese people. And then the Industrial Revolution comes, the steam engine comes, and maybe 15% of the people in the world experienced this extraordinary growth of that time. Western Europe, North America, much of the world, including China, moves kind of sideways, and over time becomes left behind. And this, a big word that many people use for this is this great divergence in history. And now what we're seeing, and China's at the center of the story, I think, is this convergence of a lot of the what we now call the emerging economies, right? Coming back, catching up, closing. There still is a significant gap, but closing this gap now with the rest of the world. And certainly that's part of how China sees itself returning to a previous state, a bit of restoring of what many Chinese people would see as the natural order of things. The current president of China certainly uses a lot of rhetoric to describe things that way. On one hand, it's political rhetoric, and it's meant for a domestic and international audience. At the same time, as you described, there are arguably benefits that come from this, right? The Chinese government, maybe this is an indication of how upside down things are in the world right now, is one of the leading proponents of globalization, right? And keeping borders open in the world. And, the economists will tell you that in general, that tends to be a good idea, though it struggles to gain political currency these days.
Can you talk about this metaphor of the pachyderm, though? Where does the elephant fit in this?
As far as shaking the world right now, the Chinese economy is huge right now. It's the second largest economy in the world. And because there are so many people in China who are still moving up the income ladder, the economy is going to still keep growing. It won't be long before, in absolute terms, the Chinese economy and the GDP are going to surpass the United States. So when China wants to export a lot of goods, it can flood the world's market with a lot of things. When China wants to put a cap on carbon emissions or slow carbon emissions, it has significant benefits for the planet. And when China wants to invest in infrastructure projects in Southeast Asia and Europe, that has a big effect. It has a big effect on individuals who can benefit from ports and pipelines and railroads, but it also means that the Chinese political footprint expands into a lot of the world, and exactly where that's going to go, that's an important question.
Not only the behemoth side of an elephant, it's also the elephant in the room now, in every sense of that.
Sure.
And there's another metaphor that I was struck by, these frescoes that you write about, and it has to do with people being, again, on the wrong side of history. Mm. This is a bank ceiling, and it becomes very important. And these are mosaic frescoes that have very westernized all the HCs and octagon and these Caucasian-looking people, and they were kind of kept covered for quite some time.
They were. So if you've been, many of our listeners, I'm sure, have been to Shanghai, and they've been along the waterfront known as the Bund. And on one side of the waterfront are these space-age skyscrapers, kind of the modern side. And on the other side is the historic colonial side of Shanghai. And one of these old buildings, one of the signature buildings from a long time ago, is this large domed building that once upon a time was the Shanghai headquarters of the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank. And this goes back to the days, early 20th century, when Shanghai, as some described it, was the Paris of the East. It was one of the leading commercial centers, one of the leading, centers of ideas and music and dancing in the world. Before I left China in 2010, my assistant said, "Scott, you need to go and look at this ceiling in the old headquarters of this bank." And it's striking when you look up and you see these frescoes. And if you look around the interior of the dome, there is a there's a piece of art for each of the branches of the bank that it had around the world at the time. There's London and Paris and Tokyo and New York.
That's your early globalization.
It goes back to this early period of modern globalization. And when the communists came and suddenly the globalization went out of fashion, it was decreed that that would be taken out of sight. But they weren't destroyed. An enterprising architect, as the story goes, decided, you know, we're going to plaster it over instead of, you know, take the tiles out and destroy it, so the history underneath someday can perhaps be revealed when it becomes politically acceptable for it to be revealed. And as I walked out of there, I thought, you know, in so many families, including mine, there is this history beneath the surface that's covered up, sometimes covered up by silence or shame, but it's there still waiting for somebody to try to find it, for it to be revealed. And that was a bit of the starting point for this book project.
It's also a kind of photoshopping. I couldn't help thinking of Mao Zedong and the Yangtze River back in the 60s, you know, which was actually, I think, not really Mao in the Yangtze River.
Right, and he claimed to, I think twice in history when politically it was important for Mao, he claimed to have crossed these gigantic rivers and, you know, swam at a pace that I think would be world record speed. So
you talk about
fact checkers at the time.
We still need fact checkers in China as well as here. But you write about China as a society built on status and avoiding shame, and that a lot about self censorship and so forth. That still holds, and in some ways, maybe even the xenophobia holds too. In a different, it's kind of morphed.
My uncle is we've talked about his great story of redemption. It started out in a very shameful way because he was connected to, you know, he was one of these persons on the wrong side of history. And I spent hours and hours with him trying to learn his story at his kitchen table in Shanghai. And afterward, he said, "Well, you know, you really can't write this story." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, a lot of it is shameful and humiliating for the family. You should only write the glorious parts." and so we suddenly have this intergenerational negotiation here. And I told him, you know, this book is going to be in English, and it's going to be mostly Americans who are going to read this. And he said, "Well, I have friends in America." I said, "Really? You have a lot of friends in the United States?" And he said, "I have six." So I think that goes to the, shame being a great silencer in Chinese society and people trying to avoid it, because Here in the U.S., I think we value open kitchens and transparency and kind of, you know, we're these oversharing people in the world. I don't think that necessarily travels, certainly to a place like China, where a lot of these stories are more instinctively kept inside.
But that gets into that question again about xenophobia. I mean, how much do the Chinese really welcome the kind of globalization and world-leading role that they now have and have assumed? I was thinking and reading your book about, I don't know if you know the writer Ha Jing, who is originally from China, who I admire a great deal and has been on this program. But so much of his fiction represents a kind of cruelty of bureaucracy and dehumanization in China. I mean, Tiananmen Square was what really made him stay in the United States. And those things, you can't simply, and we get in human rights questions and so forth, you can't simply vanquish them with globalization and with all the now capitalist, shall we say, changes that China has gone through connecting to so many other parts of the world. They're still there in China, aren't they?
I think the Chinese people and the Chinese government have long had this conflicted relationship with the outside world, this love-hate relationship. When my going back to my great-grandfather's generation and these intellectuals went to Japan and were, this is a time when China was unbelievably weak. This was the end of the Qing dynasty and it was on its knees. And the tension that these intellectuals wrote about for China was, how can we be modern and Chinese at the same time? You know, how do we, you know, as one of the as it had been articulated, how do we open the window and not let the flies in? And I think that's still the challenge today, is for the Chinese government and the economy and the people, they know they need to engage with the outside ideas. They know the education system has a lot of challenges and it's important to send students to other countries, including the United States, and attract overseas investment and kind of learn from the rest of the world as a country that came late to industrialization and globalization. At the same time, there is this historic pride in what China once was and pride in the idea of the Chinese people making it for themselves. So I think that is a continuing conflict that
tension,
the world is getting
an ongoing tension.
It is.
Yeah. Our guest again is Scott Tong, and I want to invite you, our listeners, to join us. He's written an extraordinary personal family history here, as well as a book that really traverses over the whole history of China, back in the dynastic era and up to the present, and all of the dialectic that has gone through opening and closing and opening and closing. And I know many of you have some thoughts and would like to join this conversation, thoughts about your own personal history or about Chinese history. It covers everything from the original monarchy to Japanese occupation. We've got Mao Zedong. We've got one-child policy. So much the labor camps. There's so much in the book because there's so much in his transgenerational family. Join us toll-free. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. We welcome your calls. Again, you can join us at that number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Scott Tong, who is correspondent for Marketplace and author of A Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. We do welcome your involvement. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or let us know what's on your mind or any comments or questions you might have by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And Scott Tong will be at the Half Moon Bay Brewing Company this evening at 6 o'clock. Maybe a lot of talk. He was at the World Affairs Council yesterday talking about geopolitics in China, maybe talking about brewing beer in China, or who knows, hops and malts and who knows what else. No, that's a good venue. I hope they'll appreciate you there. I want to actually, before we start taking calls and emails, get to something else that you bring up early on and actually in the preface to your book. And you're talking about two ways of viewing history, two competing ways to understand change over time, which you call the dominant rupture camp, which focuses on big turning points, French Revolution, Enlightenment, steam engine, presidents, generals. Help me with the pronunciation again.
Oh, Geiger Kaifeng, reform and opening.
Yeah, okay. Yep. And then in the opposing corner, you say that the scholars who see change through gradual evolution, their adherence of continuity. And you bring up Chinese leaders today always talking about continuity. But this is an ongoing kind of, how shall we put it, oppositional argument, a dialectic maybe as well.
I think, you know, it's very easy. Maybe the way a lot of us understand history is through these big turning points, these big turning moments, right? The stages that you talked about in presidents and kings. I think there's a lot of constituency for this rupture way of understanding history, right? Each government or regime has an interest in, you know, gets to write history and wants to write it its own way and take credit for what happened under its watch. Journalists, I think that's our social currency as well. We're always looking for a big turning point in history. I think a quieter way, a more undertold way of understanding history is what some call continuity, that a lot of the roots for a lot of the change that we understand over long sweeping periods of time, they go further back. In the case of China, in my family, going back a century to an earlier stage of globalization is, you know, that some of the roots, in my view, and a lot of historians think that way, go back there. A lot more roots go much further back than that. And I think that the idea of continuity over time is one that we should think about a little bit more and we don't talk about as often.
Well, let's see what our listeners have to say. Let me begin with you, Tune. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Fascinating discussion, Mr. Tong and Mr. Krasny. I wanted to also touch upon the continuity, not just across time, but across the Pacific Ocean. And I wanted to draw some parallels. You had mentioned nothing short of monumental development of modernization in China. I do remember, you know, the Seven Roads to Modernization Deng Xiaoping embarked on. I also remember as a watershed turning point moment for China's politics is Tiananmen Square. The massacre made a very deep impression upon me as a naturalized citizen from Burma whose parents are from southern China. And what I wanted to ask you is, what do you think of the vignette offered by Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes a couple of years ago, where there were these dozens of skyscrapers in some enterprise zone in Shanghai, just snapped up by just dozens and dozens of investors, but no one lives in them. And that kind of development, I think Professor Stiglitz has analyzed that the kind of Chinese globalization following in the mold of the world globalization has to have a cautionary tale, that what I see the parallel to this side of the ocean is America is in a phase where we have Trumpism. The kind of globalization is make America great first, and the kind of withdrawal, withdrawal from former imperial glory.
Well, you're raising a lot there, Tune, but let me go to Scott Tong and get a response. Scott?
Well, of course, Joe Stiglitz, of course, is a very influential, you know, a skeptic or raising important questions about globalization and how what the distribution of the spoils are. And I think that's a question that so many countries in the world are asking right now. And, you know, when I was in college, I remember the Berlin Wall falling, and we all thought globalization was just a one-way thing that was going to go forever. And, you know, borders were kind of yesterday's news, and just because the economists told us that it was in general a good idea, that it was somehow politically entitled to happen. And now, of course, we're learning otherwise. And when I report on globalization and ask people about, you know, kind of what happened, you know, to all these assumptions that I had in my adult life, you know, a lot of them say what policymakers did not pay attention to was the distribution, that they always knew that there were going to be winners and losers. And big question over time was how and whether to take care of the losers. And as one academic told me, no country has really done it well and figured out how to share the spoils of globalization, which in general makes the pie bigger for more people. But so I think that question of inequality is one that, you know, has shown up in electoral politics in this country and the UK and a lot of Europe. It's a question that is certainly on the minds of Chinese people as well. Ways to measure inequality, the Gini coefficient, it's very high in China. So that is a significant challenge for a lot of governments, including the Chinese government today.
Let me thank Toon for his call, and let's go to another caller right off here. Nicholas, that's you. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Thanks for the discussion. I wanted to make a comment and ask a question. You know, there's been so much talk of globalization and the growing dominance of China in the world economy. You know, maybe it's a sign of the times. You know, we live sort of in a very hyper-capitalistic age when, you know, we have a businessman as president. Like, business seems to be, everything is turning into a business of some form. All nonprofits think like businesses. It's a sign of the times. There's been so much conversation about, yes, like China could take over the world as the sort of next dominant superpower, supplanting, obviously, the former Soviet Union and of course, you know, the United States. What I'm finding, so I'm a Korean-American, you know, I'm from Korean heritage. China's sort of history, you know, that the author talks about is very much, you know, about within China and within Asia. If you're talking about on the world stage, I feel like with Chinese people who are focused on China, there is sort of an incentive to think about China as this growing power. If you're talking about people in the West, like Americans, I think the narrative of China's growing influence is also somewhat convenient because it somewhat sort of downplays and underplays the cultural element when it comes to white supremacy and white sort of normative values that have spread across the world. In order for China to accomplish these things that everyone talks about, it requires people around the world to embrace Chinese culture in so many different forms as being of value, of maybe even higher value than their own culture. I don't personally see that happening. I was curious as to what the author thinks of that.
Yeah, Nicholas, thank you for the question. Interesting question indeed. Scott?
You know, I think this idea of a growing China, an influential China,
it's mainly economic. It's not so cultural, really.
No, and there is, I think it resonates, as Nicholas says, in much of the world. Certainly in China, there is constituency for that, for the Chinese people and for the Chinese government and the Communist Party. I think as well, I live in Washington, D.C., and there's constituency for that as well to seek to frame China as this threatening kind of darker challenge to the world order and to the United States. I think that brings us to a real challenge for China going forward. The Chinese government has very, for a decade or more, thought about this term of soft power, of trying to kind of win friends in the world through the power of attraction, cultural elements and others, as opposed to hard power, right? Economic power and guns and bullets and that kind of thing. It's very aspirational for the Chinese government to try to understand what soft power is and try to leverage it in the world. The time I spend in China and when I talk to people who really think about soft power, they see it as one of the biggest challenges, that it's something, you know, whether the Chinese are good at it is still an open question.
But they're not trying to necessarily make for a Sino-cultural chauvinism or spread the Chinese culture abroad through globalization, are they?
They are. Well, the government is funding what are called Confucius Institutes, and they're bankrolling.
I know we did a whole program on that. It seemed more of wanting people to appreciate Chinese history in many respects and the contribution to the world. Yeah.
Right. They're trying to kind of gain social and cultural points around the world for people to gain more of an appreciation for Chinese history and for Chinese culture. I'm just not so sure in general how well it's being executed, because at the same time we hear, you know, very strong rhetoric coming from the Chinese government at the same time. And there are different measures of what people kind of think of China, the country, and the Chinese government. And, you know, its reputation, there's a long way to go, I think, before it builds the kind of reputation that it wants.
Well, let me thank Nicholas for his call. Wouldn't you say that there are many Chinas? I mean, just like there are many Americas. We speak about regions in the United States, the South being so different than the West and so forth. That's certainly true in an abundant way, it seems to me, about China. And here we just had a caller from families from Burma, caller from family from Korea, and yet people speak of Asian Americans as if there's, you know, one identity there in this vast continent. But China is just as vast and just as different as the continent.
And that's how early on when I moved to China, a marketing professional for multinational companies said that's how he describes China to his clients, is think of China as a continent. In his world, thinking about the different markets and types of consumers, the dialects and the kind of the different cultural personalities that different parts of China have. I mean, if you go, they don't always get along. If you go to the northern part of China, kind of the Rust Belt of China, people certainly look different. There is a dominant ethnic group, but you can, but you know, they're not 100% of China. So there are those geographic disparities, and then there is a huge urban and rural disparity in China. What a lot of people get, including me, when they first go to a place like Beijing or Shanghai, they get skyscraper syndrome, right? They think that represents everything that China is right now, and it takes a little while to understand and see the face of a country that also has hundreds of millions of people who are just developing and coming up to eat meat a couple times a week. One of my relatives in the Tong family village, you know, he had built a basic new home made out of brick, and he had cutouts for the windows, but he didn't have enough money to buy the glass for the windows yet. So a lot of Chinese people, you know, far away from the skyscrapers, still have that pretty basic existence.
It's Noel who writes, did Scott read the New Yorker article titled Making China Great Again? It discusses Xi Jinping's flattering of Trump and China's plans for global influence. You read the article?
I did, yes.
You want to comment on it at all? Noel's asking.
I've heard that phrase a lot, that
making
that
China
Xi Jinping
great again.
Wants to make China great again. And I think that's right. The phrase that President Xi uses is translated as rejuvenation, to restore China to a former place in history. So as the official framing narrative of history goes, before the Communist Party came to power, there were a couple centuries of humiliation. And so it's painted that way of certainly it wasn't all good. The colonial story is one of Western powers coming with their gunboats and seizing some of the best ports and best areas in China. So part of that is certainly true. It's more nuanced and complex than that, in my view. But certainly the Chinese, as the framing of history goes, have been waiting a long time to return to their normal state in the world. And that's the dominant rhetoric we hear.
Well, you know, all the fight over Hong Kong and Tibet and what's going on now in terms of conflict with the South China Sea, I mean, all of this is pretty much focal points within the Asian continent. And that's true about all the enmity that's existed historically with Japan. China has never been the conquering power outside of its own continent and its own region to a great extent. I mean, there was all this fear, especially during the McCarthy years, about the Reds, the Chinese Reds, you know, and they were characterized as people wanting to take over America and take over the world and so forth. But most of the conflict and most of the, shall we say, expansionism and desire for nationalistic spreading of wings has been located locally.
From inside China, I think it looks a little different than how it's described, I think, from the outside. Certainly the last dynasty during the Qing dynasty, the borders of China, they did expand to incorporate Inner Mongolia and Tibet and and the province of Xinjiang to the far west. But I think what a lot of Chinese policymakers and leaders think as far as China trying to establish alliances with Pakistan and connect economically with a number of countries where it has economic partnerships and is building railroads and ports and pipelines, is it sees itself, China sees itself as being surrounded by hostile interests who are aligned with the United States. They look out to the east and they see Japan. and they see the Philippines, and they see India. So the look from inside is, in many ways, one of, well, what are the weaknesses going forward, and how do we address those? So it, from that perspective, it's a little less kind of muscular, I think, than it might look from
the outside.
Or maybe
a little less global, too, as
yeah,
I was kind of intimating. Let me read some comments. Sonia tweets, I look forward to reading the book. My husband's family history is just as colorful. I think most immigrant stories are. We have a village, too. Heather writes, we spent summers in China. Everyone should try to observe this incredible human sea of energy, striving and hope. It's something quite moving. The resilience and adaptability of the people, despite some political social limitations, is something we all can learn from. And Mike wants to know, did any of your relatives make it here during the era of the Chinese Exclusion Act, or did they all have to wait till the immigration reform in 1965?
In my family, they did not. So the first immigrants were my parents who came in the 60s.
And we'll take some more phone calls. Let me go next to David. David, join us.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Excellent. So beautiful show as always. I try to listen to it as much as I can. I was calling with regards to your previous caller of Korean descent, saying that China has to go above and beyond to assert themselves, and exporting their values and standards would not be good enough as the American cultures are accepted worldwide. Contrary to that, actually, people do not appreciate being imposed and culture and values and standards. Each country has of their own, and they respect their own. So it's contrary to what your previous caller said. That's actually a leverage that China has, that, hey, we don't mess with you guys. We only want to build your countries and develop your economics and all that. So love to hear comments on your end. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Scott, do you want to comment?
You know, I don't hear very often from inside China the notion that the Chinese government or the Chinese people are trying to export their culture and standards in that way, in a way of trying to, gain some kind of cultural territory in the world. I don't really hear it framed in those ways. It's often described as trying to use those to attract friends in the world for a country that for a long time didn't have enough friends in the world.
Let me bring another caller aboard here. And RS is our next caller. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I think many people exaggerated China's power and growth. Well, of course, China, in my opinion, did very well compared to its past and so many other countries in the region or perhaps around the world. But if we compare China's power and growth with the United States, I think, it takes decades and years that China get to where the United States stands. And I think America, for example, has a very strong, powerful education system and has a very creative society that China does not have. For example, tens of these, technology companies existed or been created in the United States. Why not in China? Because I think it roots to, has a root in education system and also in confidence and other things. If you travel around the world or talk to young from Bangladesh, Pakistan, Middle East, Asia, they would say, they are seeking American dream or American lifestyle or American culture to be confident, creative, and nobody says I'm seeking in China's dream. What the author thinks about this?
Yeah, I think he's saying America's still the big magnet. Thoughts from you, Scott?
When I was based in China from 2006 to 2010, the movie Kung Fu Panda came out. This extraordinary hit produced by an American company. And in China, there was a wave of angst that came over the Chinese conversation. And the question was, well, how come a bunch of foreigners, a bunch of Americans can make a good movie, a funny, entertaining movie about China, and we can't do that? It was a picture of why can't the Chinese innovate and do something creative the way the Americans can? And that question is asked in a whole lot of different ways, I think, all the time in China? You know, this fundamental question of innovating when countries arrive at a certain level of...
That includes technology, as a caller intimated.
Of course, of economic development. It's important when an advanced economy comes to the technology frontier that it has to kind of keep moving beyond that frontier. And, I mean, we're sitting here in the Bay Area. That's kind of at the center of that conversation. And I was in so many conversations in China where people wanted to bring their families, their children, and their money, not necessarily entirely to the United States, but just to some of the leading thought centers in the world. I spoke to my old...
They are buying up a lot of property here.
I spoke to my old landlady during one of my research trips going back to China's wealthy Shanghai woman, and she said, of all my friends, we are all sending either our children or our money to the United States or both.
Let me thank the caller. Here's Mitko, who writes, I was in Beijing and Shanghai at the end of November. I took the fast train in between these cities, and I was stunned by what I saw, endless new construction of high-rises. If China rises to the level of Western consumption, it will affect everyone around the world. Is all this construction state-sponsored to keep unemployment low and grow the GDP? If that crashes, can we expect worldwide recession? You want to put on your economist hat here?
Certainly the government has a certain place in the Chinese economy, but it is... to a large degree, still a market economy. A lot of the investment, these big investment decisions that are made to build skyscrapers and to lend money, may not necessarily turn out to be good investments, but they're private decisions made by people with skin in the game and money on the line. The challenge for China is, over time, a lot of lending has gone to the wrong place where the money couldn't be paid back. There have been bridges built to nowhere and airports built that people didn't need. I think when a country is growing at double digits, you know, it's growing very quickly, perhaps the country can handle that kind of inefficiency. But China's slowing down. The growth rate is slowing down. It was 14% one of the years I was there, and now it's 6% and change. So it has to do things more efficiently now.
But the listener raises another important point, and that is just how much the world economy is tied to China now. I mean, there's a lot of synchronicity going on, almost immeasurably so, and beyond calculation. And so if things did go south in China economically, it really could have a stunning effect. Right now, you know, our market is pretty strong because the global market is pretty strong. The two are definitely tied together. And I'm wondering, with America dropping out of the TPP and with China doing so much investing in Africa and all, how much you just see the general picture unfolding here? I mean, it's another kind of shift in many ways, isn't it?
In the last decade or so, I think there have been times when the world economy has been wobbly and the Chinese engine has been one of the central engines kind of pushing growth forward in the world. As you say, right now, the world economy is doing pretty well. We see engines firing in a lot of different parts of the world. But China matters now in a way that it didn't even a decade ago, you know, for global growth. And we see that there are pluses and minuses. And you know, we certainly talked about perhaps some of the costs or challenges of the rest of the world trying to understand China and interact with some of these investments and a more muscular China in certain ways. But if we did the thought experiment, what happened if we didn't have the Chinese economy? The world economy of the last decade would have been a different story.
Again, we're talking to Scott Tong. His book is A Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. And let me get another caller on here, and that's you, Wanda. Hi.
Oh, good morning. I saw Shen Yun a couple of years ago. It's playing currently in the Bay Area. It's really extravagantly beautiful, makes China look wonderful historically. And someone said, this is, you know, I'm not sure if this is true, that it cannot play in China. And it doesn't make sense because it's such a beautiful view of the history of China and its many cultures. Do you have a comment? And one last question. There's an urban legend around that if a Chinese person pays about $500,000, they get some sort of specialized visa to the United States. If you can address that also, I'd appreciate it.
I appreciate the questions. There, a lot of things don't play in China, by the way, but any thoughts about, are you familiar with the film that you mentioned?
I'm not familiar with the film, but certainly the right? Chinese Culture Ministry.
It has to do with Fogang.
It has to do with Falun Gong. Yeah. Well, that is that would clearly be restricted then. Yeah. I mean, any part of that conversation would be shut down. So that would be, for the Chinese censors, I think, an easy call to if that's the case. I don't know about the visa regime. I know at a certain point there were investment visas people could apply for in Canada and the United States. I've not followed that. I don't know where the situation is now.
Here's a question from Amy, heavy question. Amy wants to know, in China and elsewhere, is there a concern that globalization is a new form of imperialism?
Well, the big question, there, if globalization, you know, it in many ways it is continuing, and there is a disparity between the winners and losers. No one ever said the distribution was going to be an equal one. So I think that will continue to be a challenge in the world. We had our experiment with turning away wholesale from globalization with the you know, the Smoot-Hawley law in the interwar period, when the U.S. was at the leading edge of closing our doors to the rest of the world, and putting up these tariffs. And what happened was the whole global economy shrank at the time. So we should also think about, I think, if you might get what you want and close the door on globalization, what might that bring?
Scott Tong, it's come to the end of the hour. Enjoy talking to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Michael, thank you.
Scott Tong is correspondent for Marketplace. His book is A Village with My Name, A Family History of China's Opening to the World. Again, you can meet the author this evening at 6 o'clock at Half Moon Bay Brewing Company. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Tomorrow, in this hour, we're going to talk to Dick Cavett. I hope you'll join us for that. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.